I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have a very special guest, Mr. Charles Gaines, the author of the book Pumping Iron and also Stay Hungry. And Charles, along with his partner, George Butler, was instrumental in changing the sport of bodybuilding by bringing the sport out into the mass media so the general public could finally get to learn what bodybuilding was all about. And I asked Charles to come back on the show because George Butler just passed away last October of 2021. And I wanted Charles to come on and talk about their friendship and about their partnership that resulted first in an article for Sports Illustrated. And then that led to the book Pumping Iron in 1974, which went on to surpass anything that anyone expected. I think it was in five printings. It was on the bestseller list for the New York Times. And then George Butler decided to do the movie Pumping Iron, which he filmed in 1975. And he was the director of that movie. And Charles was also involved in it. And that, of course, led to the resurgence of bodybuilding in the mass media. It really was the movie that brought bodybuilding out to the public. So got a very special interview coming up with author Charles Gaines in a minute. All right. So what's going on in your world, guys? My back is finally better. Of course, I hurt my back last week and kind of threw it out, and it was in pain for about 4 or 5 days, but finally got better over the weekend, and now it's back. So I'm back to the gym and I'm doing my yoga. I'm being good with that. So everything's good so far, knock on wood. I finally got some information about the seminar that I'm going to be doing in Massachusetts. And it's going to be April 2nd and 3rd of this year, so about another month from now. And I'm going to have the information in the notes below in the description. So check that out if you want to go. If you're in the area, I've got the phone number where you can contact the gym owner and set that up and reserve your spot. So it's going to be a two-day seminar the whole weekend, and we're going to do both training seminar and it's going to be a lecture series. So we're going to spend about 4 hours in the gym each day, where I'm going to go over every body part and show you how to perform the best exercises for each muscle group. And then we're going to go into the classroom and we're going to do a seminar about training and nutrition and how to set up your workout program, everything. So it's going to be a really, really extensive seminar. It's going to be very affordable too. So if you're in the area, I hope you can make it out there. It's going to be a really good experience. We got the Arnold Classic coming up in only, one more week. It'll be 1 week because it's March 3rd, which is a Thursday. That's when the amateur portion takes place. And then the contest itself will be the 4th and the 5th, which will be Friday and Saturday. And then Sunday, they will have the seminar. And they are bringing back the expo. So they've got all the sports back. And they've got the strongman event coming back. So it's going to be really, really cool to be back at the Arnold Classic. I haven't been there since, I think it was 2016. So it's been a while. So I will be doing the wrap-ups for RX Muscle along with Chris Aceto. And I'm also going to be writing the articles for Digital Muscle about the competition. And I will be at the Pro Physique booth. So if you are there, check out the Pro Physique booth. I think it's also called the Bikini booth. But if you're in the area, find it out. I will be there around 4 to 6 o'clock on Friday and Saturday because I'll be attending the other events during the day. But I will be there at the expo from about 4 to 6 o'clock on Friday and Saturday. I think I'll be there Sunday too. So come by and see me and say hi if you're in the area. I was on the podcast Most Muscular, which is on YouTube. So if you go to YouTube, check out the podcast Most Muscular. Jason Naz is the host of the show. And he usually has on Ian Harrison and Jean-Pierre Fuchs and Phil Williams. And this week, Ian was not there, so they asked me to sit in for him. And they had a doctor on, who I think the doctor's name was also Jason, and they were doing autopsies on some of the bodybuilders that passed away. So they talked about Dallas McCarver, who died, I think, in 2017 at only 26 years old. And so we went over his autopsy, and we also went over Rich Piana's autopsy. So it's pretty interesting. Check that out. And I'll be on there again this week because they're going to do an Arnold Classic preview. So if you're on YouTube, check out Most Muscular. And also check out my page on YouTube. I have the John Little interview, part one, where we talk about the life of Mike Mentzer. It's getting a lot of views. I think it's got over 4,000 views already. So, and only less than a week. So check that out. If you're on YouTube, just go under my YouTube channel under John Hansen. All right. Before we get to our interview, I do want to mention at the end of our interview, I'm going to be reading two articles. So last week I promised you Andrew Heffernan, who is one of our Patreon sponsors. Andrew writes for Men's Health, and he wrote a really interesting article about Joseph Bienna, who is Arnold Schwarzenegger's son. And this was the son that Arnold had with the maid, where he had that illicit affair. But Andrew wrote a really good article about Joseph, so I'm going to read that. And then after that, I'm going to read the famous article that Charles Gaines wrote for Sports Illustrated. And this was in the July 10th, 1972 issue of Sports Illustrated. And it's called Cutting Some Fancy Figures. And it was the article that Charles did about the 1972 Mr. East Coast contest that was won by Leon Brown. And this was the very first article ever done in Sports Illustrated about bodybuilding. So it's a really historic article. I'm going to read that as soon as we get done with our interview with Charles Gaines. So without any further ado, guys, here is our interview with Mr. Charles Gaines, the author of the book Pumping Iron and Stay Hungry. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a very special guest with us this week, Mr. Charles Gaines, who is the author of the book Stay Hungry and also the very famous book Pumping Iron. And Charles has agreed to come on the show and we can talk about the passing of his partner, George Butler, who just passed away last October. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. It's a pleasure to have you back. Well, first of all, I want to offer my condolences on the passing of your friend, George, who passed away last fall. You guys were instrumental in really helping create the sport of bodybuilding and bringing it out to the general public. So were you in touch with George a lot over the last few years, Charles?
I was, John. You're probably aware of the fact that he had Parkinson's disease for, at least a decade, maybe a decade and a half before he died. And as you know, that's a progressive disease. And the last couple of years, it was tough to be in touch with him because he could barely talk and he was bedridden. And
But
2 years ago, we had our house in Nova Scotia and had a good visit with him. And so, and after that, I talked to him for a couple of times. But the last year, he couldn't talk on the phone anymore.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah, that's a terrible disease. I did see a video of him somewhere. I think he was introducing the movie Pumping Iron to an audience. And you could tell the disease had progressed really badly.
Yeah, it's a terrible disease and it just eats you up a little bit at a time. And
yeah,
unfortunately, George is such an active guy all of his life, good athlete. And for the past, 10 to 12 years before he died, he couldn't do much of anything.
Mm, yeah, that's terrible. Well, it's been 50 years since you guys first met, right? Since you started working together in 1972. So it's amazing that much time has gone by.
Boy, you know, it seems like it seems like a week. But no, you're right. It's a long time.
Yeah. So, Charles, tell us how you and George met. I know you wrote the book Stay Hungry, and I believe that was released in 1972. And from what I read, you released a couple short stories from the book, some anecdotes of the bodybuilding section. And I think George got a hold of that somehow, and then he contacted you. Is that correct?
That's more or less correct. I was living in New Hampshire at the time, and I had an assignment from Sports Story for that magazine. And I had pitched it to them and said I wanted to go down for the Mr. East Coast contest, which was held in Holyoke, Massachusetts then. And I needed a photographer for it, and I'd heard about George. He lived in the same state that I did in New Hampshire. So I got in touch with him, asked him if he wanted to take the photographs for the story. He said, sure. We went down, covered the story. Leon Brown won it at that point, and got along well. And while we were down there doing that story, we met Mike Katz and some other people, and kept hearing about this young Austrian who had just moved to America and started his career over here. And so then we got the story that we did for Sports Illustrated did very well. And it was the first one they'd ever done. They got a lot of great mail about it. So we decided to do another article and go down and meet Arnold at the Mr. I think Universe contest, maybe 1973, something like that. No, it wouldn't have been, I forget the year, John, but went down to the Brooklyn Academy, met him, and then everything took off from there.
Yeah. So now you both, you and George, kind of had some experience with bodybuilding. I read some stuff about George, and he grew up in several different places, but one of the places he grew up was Jamaica. And of course, bodybuilding was always really popular out there. There's a lot of great bodybuilders that come from Jamaica. So I guess he was sort of introduced to the sport back then, and he saw some bodybuilding competitions. And you grew up in Alabama, and a lot of that was the basis for your book, Stay Hungry, because you got introduced to bodybuilding as a teenager, right?
That's correct. Boy, you've done your research. that's correct. George had some experience with it in Jamaica, and I started lifting weights when I was about 16 for football, and worked out in a gym in downtown Birmingham, got to know some amateur bodybuilders, and thought it was an interesting subculture, and nothing had really been written about it at the time. So I went to some competitions and then wrote Stay Hungry as a result of that experience.
Was that your first book, Charles, Stay Hungry?
It was. That was my first book.
Wow. How old were you when you wrote that book?
I think it was published when I was 29 or 30.
Okay.
It was published when I was just after I'd turned 30 years old.
Okay. So the character, Joe Disco, that's in the book. Well, no, it was Joe Santos. I'm sorry. Joe Santos was in the book. Was that based on Joe Disco, who you wrote about a little bit in Pumping Iron?
That's correct. It was based on my great buddy, Joe Disco, who has also passed away. And it was interesting, John, because during the filming of the movie down here in Birmingham, Arnold was playing him, and an interesting experience for both of them. And they got to be good buddies.
Oh, okay. Really? That's cool. Yeah. Yeah. So the term pumping iron, that came from Alabama, right? When you were, wasn't there someone there that used to pronounce it pumping iron?
that's exactly right. Yeah. Right. My great friend, John Gunn, and I used to, we were both 16, and we were both playing football, and we were both sort of on the thin side, and we needed to beef up. So we had a friend named Fred Crabb who had some weights down in his basement, and Gunn used to say, "Gaines, let's go pump iron," A-R-N, when he pronounced it. That's the
right.
Iron. And so we started going down to Fred Crabb's place, and then we graduated to John. Back, it's hard to credit this, but back then in the early 50s, bodybuilding was not on the map, really. I mean, you know, it was a subculture known by, participated in by the people who did it. But other than that, there were a lot of shibboleths, a lot of myths about bodybuilders that were lifted weights, you'd get muscle bound and you couldn't be a good athlete. And it was a guy named, his last name was Cannon. He was a Heisman Trophy winner in 1954 or 55. I forget his first name. I think he played for LSU, and he worked out at this gym that Gunn and I went to, and he won the Heisman Trophy. The first football player to really seriously lift weights in an effort to get bigger and stronger.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were a lot of myths about bodybuilding. One of my interests in writing Stay Hungry was to address those myths and try to correct them.
Yeah. How did you first get involved in bodybuilding, Charles? I mean, you got involved as a teenager, right? You're like 14 or something.
Yeah, I was about 16. And as I say, I started in an effort to get bigger for football.
Okay.
And then started going to this gym and met this group of guys who were, Joe Disco being the main one of them, but there were maybe a half a dozen guys who were participating in amateur bodybuilding competitions. Joe Disco won Mr. Alabama at one point. And so I thought it was really interesting. And I started going around to competitions with them and hanging out with them. And it was a lively, vivid, fascinating subculture that nobody knew anything about. And I thought it would make great material for a first novel.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was a different world back then because the, you know, things have changed so much. The gyms are so much bigger now. And, you know, I notice when I go to the gyms now, nobody really talks to anyone because everybody has their headphones on, they're on their phones, and they're kind of in their own, they're kind of in their own world. Where back then, because I started bodybuilding in the late 70s, so I can kind of relate to what you're saying. It was just a smaller gym and everybody knew one another and there was, you know, good camaraderie and you got to know some real characters in the gym.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're right. Back then, there were no headphones, of course, and it was a much more social experience working out in a gym than it is now.
Yeah, yeah. So you guys did this article for Sports Illustrated, and I was looking at Randy Roach's book, Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, and he put some excerpts of that article in here, and I wanted to just read a little bit of it, if you don't mind. Because I thought one of the things with you, Charles, you're a fantastic writer. You're one of my favorite authors. But that book, Pumping Iron, was so great because it exposed the world of bodybuilding to the general public. But you didn't do it like a muscle magazine would, you know, like a writer for a bodybuilding magazine who is reading, you know, writing for an audience that understands the sport. You wrote this article based on this contest you saw for the audience out there, the general public that would read Sports Illustrated. And I thought that was really fascinating, the way you conveyed it and the way you explained the world of bodybuilding to the general public.
Well, that's very perceptive of you. And that's exactly right. That's what I set out to do, you know, because there were plenty of people writing for the Weider magazines and the bodybuilding audience. What I wanted to do with that article and then later with Stay Hungry and then later with Pumping Iron was to try to bring bodybuilding to a much larger audience than it had at the time. I thought there was a much larger audience out there capable of appreciating bodybuilding that was not being reached by the Weider magazines and so forth. And so I sort of took it on myself to try to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, if you don't mind, I'm going to read this one little excerpt from here. Say, before anything begins on stage at a body contest, the audience always knows who is there. You spot them as they walk in. Bodybuilders are often individualistic to the point of kinkiness, and they have a way of standing out. As Mike Katz says, they are the only athletes whose sport you can tell by looking at them. It's not just their size that accounts for this or even their fabulous proportions. It has more to do with an odd variety of self-consciousness, a highly developed aesthetic sense of self that comes from having more or less the same relationship to your own body that an artist does to his artwork. I thought that was great.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, that whole subject of the relationship of a bodybuilder to his body being similar to that Phidias, say, the 4th century BC Greek sculptor who did all of these muscular bodies in sculpture. It's a very interesting connection because, you know, good bodybuilders, the best bodybuilders really are able to, as you know, to take on and, you know, to put on and take off weight and inches and size on muscles and to virtually sculpt them to create an aesthetic concept that's in their mind. And that's a fascinating thing. There's no other place in that I know of in the world where that's true, where you right. See your body as a potential work of art and then proceed to make it into that.
Yeah, it's a completely unique sport, unlike anything else. And even the way that it's looked at and judged, we're not judging by who can throw the javelin the farthest or who can lift the most weight. We're judging from an aesthetic point of view. And the judging is so important to bodybuilding in order to pick the right person, because you have to look at a bodybuilder and pick the best combination of aesthetics and shape and muscle mass and definition. And that's why I think bodybuilding is just really like, it's one of the most, it is the most unique sport around it.
That's quite true. And unique is the right word. There's nothing like it, which is what made it, for me, really interesting material to deal with as a writer, because it is unique. And at the time that I started writing about it and George started photographing it, other than the bodybuilding magazines, there was no public consciousness of it and no journalists out there trying to bring it to a wider audience.
Right, right. There's another part of that article, and this is something I think is really important, which is the posing. And, you said, I think in the book Pumping Iron, it's either the most beautiful thing you can witness or the most ridiculous thing you can witness based on how it's done, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, when, as you well know, when bodybuilding is done by somebody whose body is not ready to be on stage and or who can't pose, it's embarrassing.
Yeah. 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 I remember the story.
And yet when it's done by an Arnold or a Frank Zane or an Ed Corney, it's beautiful.
Yeah. It's mesmerizing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember when we did our interview a couple of years ago, you were telling me this story about Kurt Vonnegut, the author, and him and his wife went to a contest with you, and they got to see Corney. And he was just blown away by that.
He was blown away by it. And so was his wife, was a woman named Jill Kremitz, and she was a famous photographer. And at that time, I had a lot of female friends who were photographers for some reason in New York. Jill was one of them. The actress Candace Bergen was a great buddy of mine. And she was, before she was an actress, was a terrific photographer. And Mary Ellen Mark was another one. And all of these photographers, whether they were male or female, who had never seen bodybuilding before, knew nothing about bodybuilding. The first experience they had with it was always just mind-blowing for them. I mean, they thought it was the most overwhelming visual experience they'd ever had. So both Kurt and Jill felt that way at that contest that I took them to.
Yeah. If you'll indulge me again, I just want to read this other part of this article from Sports Illustrated. You're talking about the posing, and you said, it is in these routines that body contests are won and lost, and where the peculiar essence of the sport best manifests itself. Good posing is partly a technical matter of knowing how to exhibit your strong points and obscure any weak ones. But beyond that, it is an ability like diving or hitting a baseball that depends on intuitive resources of timing and coordination. If it is done as Leon Brown does it during a couple of minutes, he occupies the dais with perfect dignity and finish. There is nothing ridiculous or even remotely embarrassing about it. Suddenly, it is no longer a greased, nearly naked man you are watching, but a clean, hard geometry of circles and curves. That was great.
Yeah, no, that's, and as you well know, that's exactly right. Leon Brown was a great poser, had one of the best backs of all time. And, you know, to watch him was a very dignified experience of art.
Yeah. Yeah, we lost Leon last year too, unfortunately. He passed away.
Yeah, yeah.
It was those photos at this contest that George took of Leon's back that appeared in the book Pumping Iron, correct?
That's right. And that's, to my mind, that's still one of the greatest bodybuilding pictures ever taken.
Oh my God, it's unbelievable. Yeah. Yeah, that whole page of just Leon posing his back, it's unbelievable.
It really is. If you kind of take the head off at the top and the waist off at the bottom, it looks like some sea creature. It looks like some...
Right. Yeah.
You know, and, yeah. That's a great Totally. Among many, many great photos that George took over the years.
So from what I read, after you guys covered that Mr. East Coast contest and it was published in Sports Illustrated, that article was very well received, wasn't it?
It was very well received. The woman, the article's editor at the time in Sports Illustrated was a woman named Pat Ryan. And she was wonderful at picking up young writers like myself and Jim Harrison and Tom McGuane, who were doing feature articles for the magazine at the time that were a little sort of off-center, a little eccentric. She appreciated that kind of thing, allowed me to do it. It was, when I first broached it to her, she said, "Bodybuilding? We've never done anything on bodybuilding. You really think that comes under the heading of sport?" I said, "Yeah, I do. And I think, I think I can give you an article that your readers will enjoy." So she went out on a limb to let me do that. And it turned out very well. And they got a lot of great mail about it. And then that allowed me to go on to do a second story for a magazine called We, O-U-I, right, the French, that's now defunct. And then that kind of parlayed into the book Pumping Iron.
Yeah. And from what I read, we didn't want any pictures, but George came with you. And then I guess he was taking photos for the Village Voice, which was a magazine out in New York. Yeah,
that's right.
So now that contest was the 1972. I believe it was the Mr. America, Mr. World, which was in New York. And you got to meet Ed Corney and Mike Katz, correct?
Actually, we had met Mike Katz at the Mr. East Coast contest.
Okay.
The one that we went down to, I'm so bad on dates, I'm so old, they just,
Well, it was a while ago.
But the contest that we went down to cover for We was the one that where we met Arnold for the first time. And
I believe Arnold was guest posing at that show, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. So I don't remember what the contest was, and 72 sounds about right, but that's what we call. And a lot of those guys, Ed Corney, I think, was there.
I think Ed won the Mr. America and Mike won the Mr. World and Arnold was guest posing.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
So that was in September of 72. And then in November of that year was the Mr. Universe that was in Baghdad, and Ed and Mike were both competing in that contest because they'd won those other two shows. So they were qualified to compete in the universe. So in between that time, had you approached, was it Doubleday Publishing about doing a book about bodybuilding?
Yeah, that's a long story. Doubleday had published Stay Hungry. And Stay Hungry had done very well and had been a finalist for the National Book Award and bought for a movie and so forth. And so Doubleday was very happy with me. And the head of Doubleday at that point was a guy named Sandy Richardson. And I went to Sandy and said, "I want to do this book on bodybuilding, follow these guys around to Baghdad and South Africa where the Olympia contest was held." And he said, "We love you. We really believe in your career and everything, but that's not going to work for us. Bodybuilding, nobody pays any attention to bodybuilding, but other bodybuilders and homosexuals, and, it's not going to sell 10 copies. And, we're just not going to do that." So I went then to, I had a contact at Harper & Row. I went to them. They said basically the same thing. And then I was down visiting a friend of mine in Key West, and there was a young agent down there named Bob D'Attila. And my agent at the time was an older man named Dermot Russell. And he had also passed on this book. He said, "I don't want to represent it." So I was down at this friend of mine in Key West and telling them about the sad history of trying to get this book sold. And Bob D'Attila said, "Get it sold for you. I'll represent it for you." So we went back to New York, George and I did, with Bob, and went in to see Dan Green, who was then high up in Simon & Schuster, and he bought it.
Wow. So you go out to Baghdad, you and George go out to Baghdad to cover this contest, the Mr. Universe contest. So tell me a little bit about that event, because you said from what I read, it was that was obviously a totally different event than the shows you had seen in the United States, because they had hundreds of athletes. They had, I think, 32 countries. And the way that the Iranian government had treated Ben Weider and gave, you know, they really treated this contest as a huge spectacular event, right?
Yeah, I mean, bodybuilding is, I think, at least at that time, second most popular sport in the country, in Iraq. And all over the Middle East, actually. And there were some very good bodybuilders represented there. It was a wild, wild experience. The enthusiasm was much higher than anything that we'd seen in the States or anywhere else for that matter. And, you know, the auditorium was packed and people screamed. More like a rock concert than a bodybuilding competition.
Yeah.
And, you know, these people would sweep Ed Corney off the streets and carry him around the shoulders. That put together with Baghdad itself, which was at that point a very exotic town, made it an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, yeah. I remember the pictures in the book, Pumping Iron, where Mike's walking down the street and people are just swarming him and everything. And I talked to Mike and he said he was a little nervous about going over there because he was Jewish going into a different country. But he couldn't believe the response he got when he got there.
Yeah, it was incredible. Something I'll never forget. It was, you know, of all the bodybuilding competitions I've been to, it was the most, by far the most memorable.
Yeah. And then, of course, the picture of Ed winning the Mr. Universe contest that year is the picture that graced the cover of the book, Pumping Iron, and then later on, the movie poster for Pumping Iron.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was a very happy man over there. He, you know, Ed never did really get, I thought, the attention that he deserved in the States, because for my money, he was the best poser of all time. And that made it doubly gratifying for me and for George to see all the attention and the love and the adulation that he got over there in Iraq. It was, you know, he just lapped it up.
Yeah. 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 It's always known for his posing, but I think people start to forget how great his physique was too. He had a fantastic physique.
Oh yeah, no, he did. And he came into that contest in like perfect shape. Mike was in great shape too, but Ed was just had that little bit of extra finish to his body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I read an article by Ed a couple of years later. It was after he was training with Arnold in 75, and he was a training partner of Arnold. And it was a really introspective article where he talked about his journey in bodybuilding. And he said that every bodybuilder has one pivotal contest that kind of defines their career. And if they win that contest, it changes everything, you know. And he said that contest for him was the Mr. Universe. And after he won that contest, he realized that he was a champion and that he belonged up there. And it just changed his whole mindset.
Yeah, you could actually see that. I think it was not only the fact that he was in such wonderful shape and beat a much bigger man, but also the way the crowd reacted to him and the judges. It all just really hit his confidence up a big notch.
Yeah. So the other contest you guys covered for the book Pumping Iron was in 1973, which was the Mr. Olympia contest. And so how did that work, Charles? Did you and George move out to California and spend the whole summer out there and kind of record everything?
We did, John. We spent pretty much the whole summer out there, and we'd go to the gym every day and stay with those guys when they're working out in the morning, and then we'd go to lunch with them. We'd go out to the beach when they went out and went to parties with them, and we just started living their life for 3 months.
Yeah. And you were kind of working out with Arnold a little bit, weren't you, at times?
I sure was. Yeah. 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 I mean, in my own much diminished way, yeah.
What was that experience like, training with Arnold Schwarzenegger in 1973 when he was at his peak?
Well, it was great. It was not just Arnold, but, you know, Denny Gable and forget some of the names, but it was a great group of Szabo and great group of guys out there then who all trained with a tremendous amount of intensity and good humor, a lot of fun, you know. I mean, they had great fun, and so it was a great experience. I loved every minute of it.
Yeah, yeah. Kent Keene was the other guy, right, that was training with you guys?
Yeah, Kent Keene, that's right, yeah.
So you said you met Arnold the year before, right, in 72, at one of those contests you were at.
Yeah, the first time I remember meeting Arnold, I'm pretty sure this is right, was at that contest that we covered for We Magazine.
Okay, the Mr. America, Mr. World, yeah.
Right.
And you guys went out to breakfast the next day, and you got a sense of his personality and his ambition, of course.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, the minute George and I met Arnold, you know, we knew he was going to be a star, mm-hmm. some kind of another. I remember back, we were staying at the Algonquin Hotel. We went back to the hotel, and George and I were sharing a suite, and he said, "You know what? We ought to be this guy's agent." We're not in the agent business. Let's leave that to somebody who knows what they're doing. But
yeah,
the point he was making was that it was obvious to both of us that Arnold was going to do pretty much whatever he wanted to do. And also at that point, John, he actually told us on that trip that his plan was to become the greatest bodybuilder in the world, to become a movie actor, and then he'd go into American politics. He had his whole career down pat from the get-go.
Yeah. So what was it about him that made you guys so convinced that he was going to be a star one day? Was it just his overall appearance because he was such a big guy? And what was it about Arnold that gave you that impression that he was going to be a star? Was it just his overall physical presence, or was it his charisma, or was it like the things he was telling you?
Yeah, I mean, it was all of those things, really. I mean, mm-hmm. Arnold is one of the most charismatic people in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when he was in great shape and young and everything, he would just, in any room that he walked into. And, you know, George and I both had lived a lot at that point and seen a lot of people, knew a lot of people, and knew a lot of charismatic people. But Arnold was in a different league. So there was that. And it was also, you know, from the minute you meet Arnold, you're conscious of the unbelievable, ferocious, concentrated ambition that mm-hmm. he had.
Mm-hmm.
And almost palpable in him. And it was then too. And so it was like, you know, he was telling us he was going to do all these things with his life that if you'd heard it from a normal person, you'd say they're dreaming. But with Arnold, it came across as being not only realistic, but probable.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It really is fortunate the way things worked out, the series of events, the way it worked, because without you and George, Arnold may never have been known to the general public. He might have just been featured in Weider magazines. I don't know. I mean, he had such ambition, but you guys were such a big part of bringing him out to the general public with the book and then the movie.
You know, I think that's right, John. And he acknowledges that. You know, we just happened to be, I think I wrote in Pumping Iron, people say that George and I discovered Arnold. We didn't. It was like we just walked around a corner and there was Mount Everest. You know, we just happened to be to see it and to want other people to see it and write about it and photograph it.
Yeah, yeah. So you go to 1973 and you go to the Mr. Olympia contest. And, of course, you cover the whole contest scene that summer. And also, I thought that was beautifully written in the book Pumping Iron, and George's photographs were amazing. The whole gym scene. I mean, George was taking pictures of the bodybuilders in the gym in a way that I never saw. I guess it was him coming from an outsider's perspective. And of course, he was a very talented photographer, and he was also a filmmaker and a writer himself. So just the way he was looking at, you know, the photos in that book are just so different than any other photos I've ever seen of any other bodybuilders.
Yeah, they are. I mean, you know, when we first got out there to California, John, we met, we'd been reading the magazines, you know, the Weedo magazines, to keep it up with it. And we met, who was Artie Zeller, and some of the others who were writing and photographing about bodybuilding. And we made a conscious decision that we discussed to try to do things differently than they were doing it. Because those guys, I mean, there were some very good writers writing for the magazine, and Artie Zeller was a terrific photographer, and there were other good photographers, but they were preaching to the choir, so to speak. I mean, they knew that whatever they wrote and however they photographed it was going to be automatically, the context would be automatically understood by their audience. We were sort of aiming our sights at a different audience, and we felt like we needed to take a different slant on how we represented bodybuilding, both pictorially in George's case and in terms of writing in my own case.
Yeah, and I think it was the combination of your writing and George's photos that made that book such a hit. How did you guys feel when you finished it and it was done before it was published? How did you feel about the whole book? Were you really excited about it, coming out?
Yeah, we were excited about it. I don't think we didn't have any idea it would be the success it was. I mean, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for 52 weeks or something. So, you know, it did extremely well. Sold a lot of copies, but partially because of George's genius for self-promotion, for promoting it. I mean, we hired a publicist in New York named Bobby Zarum, who was at that point one of the top publicists in New York. And we brought Arnold and some of the other guys to New York and took them around to places where they could be met by the kind of people who make things happen. I mean, we introduced Arnold to Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson and Woody Allen. And we arranged a lunch for him with Jackie Kennedy. And all of this was Bobby Zarum helping us out, the publicist helping us out. And we had parties. And then we staged that thing, which you probably remember hearing about, at the Whitney Museum, which a whole lot of people. And so we never really thought at the beginning that the book would, I mean, we always thought it would sell some copies. We knew bodybuilders would buy it, but we had no idea it was going to be the hit it was. And the fact that it was that hit was enabled all of the work that George and Bobby Zarum, and to a lesser degree, I, contributed in terms of public relations for it.
Yeah. I saw Mark Martinez's documentary about the golden age of bodybuilding, and you were a part of that. You gave some interviews in there. And I never realized that you guys were doing that and kind of promoting the book in New York before it was released. So then when it was released, it just right away went to the top.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, George and I had a lot of, we'd been around New York for a long time. We had a lot of celebrity friends, and we were able to get them interested in this thing. And so, you know, they all tell their friends and everything. So it had a kind of cachet that it would not have had otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. So we go into 1975 then, and then George decides he wants to make a documentary about the movie Pumping Iron. And I think you at the time were involved with making Stay Hungry into a movie, and you were out in Alabama at the time, right? Because they were filming that at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, that's right. That's correct.
Yeah. So did George want you to get involved with the movie as well? Did he want you to be a part of it? I mean, I know you were the narrator of the movie, but did he want like a bigger part?
Yeah, he did. He and Jerome Gary, who was instrumental in the making of Pumping Iron and often gets left out of the mix when people discuss them. But Jerome was the producer of the movie. And so he and George came down to Alabama to visit me while we were shooting down there. And George said, you know, we're going to make this movie. We're trying to raise some money. We'd like to have you involved any way you want to be involved. And the time, there wasn't much I could do to help out with it, but I agreed to write the script, which I did, and to narrate it, and to go on some of the filming part of it where George and Jerome thought I could be helpful.
Okay. Yeah, because that's another fascinating story in its own, which is Stay Hungry. because you write this novel, it's your first novel, and then it gets nominated for the National Book Review, and then, you know, which is a prestigious award. And then they decide, Hollywood decides to make it into a movie. So you got Bob Rafelson as a director, and he wants you to co-write the script with him, and you guys co-write the script together. And then you're out there in Alabama filming a movie about your first novel. I mean, what an accomplishment.
Yeah, no, it was, I'd like to claim credit for that. It just landed in my lap, John, to tell you the truth.
I just
lucked out. I've had two things in my life. It's rare to have even one, but this, and also I was one of the co-inventors of paintball, and
right. And
that too kind of just fell in my lap. So I've had the great pleasure and honor of having two things that had a small effect on the culture just land in my lap, and had a great time being involved with both of them.
Yeah. Well, how was the trip to South Africa that year, Charles, when you went out there to watch the Mr. Olympia contest?
Oh, it was great. You know, at that time, by then, George and I were really good friends with Arnold and with Franco and with, you know, all of those guys who went out to the contest. And we got to hang out with Reg Park, who was Arnold's hero and who lived in South Africa, and go to vineyards. And we went down to Cape Town and dropped acid in a park down there. And I mean, we had... We really had a trip. That was a wonderful time. It was, again, like Baghdad, it was one of those kind of once-in-a-lifetime experiences, and we loved every minute of it.
Yeah. And you were also the one of the commentators, right, on Wide World of Sports when it was actually shown on TV.
That's right, yeah. I got to be a judge, an IFBB judge, and... actually was one of the judges in that competition. And so Wide World asked me to do some color commentary on bodybuilding for them and did that for a while. You know, my theory about life, John, and I'm old enough to have a theory about life, mm-hmm. is that you got to have fun in everything you do. You know, I mean, if you're not having fun at it, you ought to get into some other kind of work. And writing has been wonderful for me because, you know, I've done a lot of writing on fly fishing, which is my major passion. And I've been able to write about the things that I love to do and have fun with them. You know, I never cared about all that much money. I just cared about loving what I do and meeting good people and having great experiences. And at the end of the day, when you're through with an experience like the bodybuilding experience, to look back on it and say, you know, that was a great time and a great thing to do. And I just am so fortunate, you know, to have been the beneficiary of it.
Yeah. Now you've written many books, Charles, but when you write a fiction book, do you think it's good to write about something that you're familiar with, that it's kind of comes from your world and you have a good understanding of it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the cardinal rules of writing is write what you know about.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, if you don't know about something and you want to write about it, don't write about it first. Go out and learn about it first and then write about it.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to experience it, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, you know, the experience is either visible or not visible on the page. You can't invent. The little writing is all about details, mm-hmm. and you can't invent the details. They have to come from firsthand experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus, I would imagine, like when you wrote Stay Hungry, just knowing all those characters in the gym, and that was a great part of that book because, you know, the book was about the real estate guy that Jeff Bridges played in the movie, but it was also about the bodybuilding subculture and Joe Santos, and I think that's what lent so much color to the book, too.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, at that point, by the time I came to write the book, I had spent 5 years, I guess, hanging out with bodybuilders. And, you know, I knew enough about the culture to be able to write about it legitimately. And I came from the culture that Jeff Bridges represents in the movie. So, you know, I was writing what I knew.
Yeah.
And I honestly say that in the 25 or 24, whatever the number is, books that I published, they're all about things I knew pretty intimately.
Yeah. How did you feel about the movie Stay Hungry when it was released?
I have mixed feelings about that movie. It didn't do very well, but it became a kind of cult classic. I think there were good and bad elements to it. I don't think Bob quite got the Southern, the Jeff Bridges part of the culture exactly right. Mm-hmm. And I think there were some great performances. Arnold was incredible in it. Sally Fields was great. Jeff was great. It was not the movie. It was not the book. You know, I mean, the book is Bob Rafelson, the director, had just lost a daughter tragically to a fire.
Oh, really?
And, she had been killed in a fire. And when that was only a few months before we met. And when we met, he said, "Listen, he said, your book is a tragedy. I want to make a comedy, and I don't want to make a sad movie. And so, do you think you can go along with that as the writer or the co-writer of it?" And I said, "Well, let's see. Let's write up a script and see." So we did, and I thought the script was good and the performances were good. A movie, to some extent, like a book, has a certain kind of indefinable magic that it either has or it doesn't have. And that's a result of a lot of things coming together, that some of which you can control, some of which you can't.
Yeah.
And that movie didn't quite have all of the magic that I would like to for it to have had, but it was the best effort we could make at the time.
Yeah. Arnold was really great in the movie. I mean, he had an acting coach, right? Because they required him. Well, they had a lot of reservations about hiring him for the Bob Rafelson didn't want to hire him for the part, right? Because he wasn't a known actor.
Well, no, I had to talk Bob into it. He was a hard who was a bodybuilder in his spare time. I said, "You can't do that with this role. You got to have the real thing. It's got to be, when they see this, the audience, they've got to know that this is something they've never seen before."
Yeah.
And I knew Arnold could off. So I kept bringing Arnold over to Bob's house. And of course, like with everybody, the more Bob got to know him and the more he saw how powerful a personality Arnold was, the more he could pull it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you could tell he went to the acting coach because his acting is really good in that movie,
Oh, yeah. No, I think he won a Golden Globe Award. He won some kind of award for. Yeah.
His acting debut. Yeah.
No, he did it. Yeah. He did a phenomenal job and he worked his butt off at it.
Really?
You know, I mean, he'd watch the dailies every day and he worked much harder than Jeff or Sally did because he was new to it, and he knew that this was something he was coming to that he had to really learn from the bottom up.
Yeah. Yeah. I read an article where he was talking about how intimidating it was to work with actors like Jeff Bridges and Sally Field and to be in a major Hollywood movie, to be cast as like basically the third lead. And he had no acting experience. It was totally new to him,
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of unheard of, really. To take a guy off the street with an accent like that, mm-hmm. and a body like he had, and put him in a major feature film. It was a brave thing for Bob Rafelson to do, and it was a brave thing for the studio to greenlight the film.
Yeah. What's interesting about both your book and the movie Pumping Iron is the publishing company didn't want to, you had to go through Doubleday and then finally Simon & Schuster, and they were very reticent about doing the book. And then the same thing happened with the movie. When you guys finished the movie, George was having a lot of problems with financing it. And that's, like you said, that's when you did that Whitney Museum of Art and you helped, promote the movie to make some money for it.
Right, exactly. No, I mean, it was an uphill struggle the whole way, John. I mean, because bodybuilding had lived for so long in the shadows, so to speak, we're luckily well connected enough so that we could knew the people to go to raise the money, and we believed in the project.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first thing. You got to believe in what it is. And if you believe in it strong, that carries over to the people that you're trying to sell on it.
Yeah. Whose idea was it to take it to the Whitney Museum of Art and do that Muscle is Art or whatever it was called? I mean, that was a fantastic night for Bobby.
Yeah, it was a great experience. I think it was Bobby Zarems. I tell you, we hired him. And Bobby was at that point probably the top publicist in New York, and he knew everybody. He had a great flair for doing the unexpected, which in public relations is a tremendous talent. And I'm pretty sure it was his idea. And either George or Bobby had a contact at the Whitney, and I went with Bobby and George when we went to the meeting with the people at the Whitney to try to sell them on it. And that, again, was a tough sell. It was not something they ever thought they'd wind up doing, but they did, and it was a phenomenal success. I mean, you know, we had people lined up out on 53rd Street trying to get in the front door of the Whitney. The auditorium was standing room only, and we had all kinds of celebrities there, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, I saw the outtakes from Pumping Iron, and they're stacking the money on the floor. They had no place to put the money because they had so many people coming in.
That's right. That's right. I don't know whether you know it or not, but Netflix is doing a three-part series on Arnold's life.
Yeah.
And they came down here to Alabama a few months ago to interview me. And they had all kinds of outtakes of the Whitney that I'd never seen before.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. So that was a big kick to see that footage from that long ago. And I remember back on that. It was, all of that was just so much fun. And that was one of the most fun parts of it.
Yeah, the producer of that series or that special contacted me because I guess he was watching my podcast and he saw me interview some of the people that Arnold had competed with. So he wanted to reach out to them. So, yeah, I was aware of that.
Yeah. And I think it's going to be very good. They've got a terrific woman, female director and great producers. And Netflix has got the dough to do a good job on it. So I think it's going to be really good.
That's awesome. So when Pumping Iron was released, what did you feel? What was the reason? You know, what was your feelings on that? Because it was kind of released in art houses and it really wasn't a big hit that it would later become years later.
Yeah. To begin with, we had limited distribution. We were a very small distribution company. After the movie started to gain a little traction, a much bigger distribution deal came our way and we took that and that got it out to a lot more places. So that was what made the difference there.
Okay. Yeah, I remember when it was released, because I actually saw it in the theater in 1977 when it was released. I lived in Chicago at the time. I think I was 14 years old. So I had to have my parents drive me down to this small theater in an art house theater in Chicago. And I saw it there. But then I think it was like a year or two later, it was on PBS. And they were playing it a lot. And I think that's where it really gained an audience.
Yeah, exactly. And it's still got an audience. It's on, somebody told me the other day, it was on YouTube. And, you know, I mean, it's still being watched and I still get emails about it.
Yeah.
So, it's had some legs for sure.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. It was a fantastic book and a fantastic movie. And it really did change the sport of bodybuilding by bringing so many of the people outside our world into the bodybuilding world and understanding it and appreciating it. And I think you brought, it was kind of like the best example of what bodybuilding could be. I thought, you know, the book and the movie was the best example of bodybuilding. It was kind of the higher achievement of it, you know?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. You know, we, as I said, we had a great time during that whole process. And we, George and I, were proud of the results and proud of the work we did and treasured the friendships that we made while we were doing it.
Yeah. Any final thoughts on George, Charles, you know, your 50-year friendship and all you guys accomplished together?
Well, you know, he was a great friend and a great filmmaker, and he was one of the most tenacious people I ever knew. He, you know, Public Enemy was not the only film that he made that was difficult to get off the ground. All of his documentaries were hard to raise money for. There was some question about how much audience there would be for him. But when George believed in something, nothing would stop him from carrying through on it. You know, he managed to get every one of the films that he wanted to make, he managed to make. So that's, he had a great career.
Yeah. Well, thank God for you and for him, because I think, like I said, you guys really made such an impact on the sport of bodybuilding and, of course, on Arnold's career as well. So, you know, it's just great destiny that you were able to meet back 50 years ago and do that first article for Sports Illustrated. And then you really changed the history of the sport.
Well, it was our pleasure to do so. And let me just say that I'm a big admirer of you and your show. And it's a pleasure and an honor to be on it.
Oh, thank you, Charles. Well, I did an interview with you a couple of years ago. It was one of my favorite interviews. And we weren't able to see each other, so at the time we did it over the phone. So I'm really glad you were able to come back and do this interview with me again. And it was really a pleasure to speak with you.
It was my pleasure. And I'm still hoping to get a chance to meet you sometime in the flesh.
Yeah, for sure. If you're out here to Tampa, we'll get together for sure.
The same goes for you if you're ever in Nova Scotia or Birmingham.
Okay. Yeah. All right. How often are you in Birmingham?
We live actually on a lake about 30 miles outside of Birmingham, 6 months a year. And the other 6 months, we're in Nova Scotia, Canada.
Okay. When are you in Birmingham? During the summer?
No. In the winter. Yeah. We're here from November until the end of April.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll definitely come out there one day and we'll have to get together.
Yeah, that would be great. I've got a little gym in my basement. We can work out together.
All right. Good. All right, Charles Gaines,
all right,
thank you. Thank you very much for joining me on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. It was a real pleasure talking to you, sir.
It was my pleasure, and all the best to you.
All right. Thanks, Charles. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you so much to Charles Gaines for coming on the show. It was really a pleasure to talk to him. As I mentioned in the interview, I think I did my last interview with Charles a couple of years ago, and that's still one of my favorite interviews ever. So it's really an honor to talk to the author of the book, Pumping Iron. And like I mentioned in the interview, I really feel that him and his partner, George Butler, changed the sport of bodybuilding forever. So without them, our sport would not be where it is. And who knows, we may never have heard of Arnold Schwarzenegger. He may never have made to the success that he had in the film industry and in politics. So thanks to Charles and George for bringing Arnold out into the public. All right. So I got two articles I want to read for you guys before we go. The first one, as I mentioned, is from Men's Health. It's written by Andrew Heffernan, who is a writer for there. And Andrew is one of our loyal listeners. He's also one of our Patreon sponsors. So I want to do him a favor by reading his article, which was really good. And it's called Joseph Bienna Found Out Arnold Schwarzenegger Was His Dad. Now He's Learning From Him. The son of the fitness culture's greatest icon is on a quest to become an actor, build his best body, and be the strongest version of himself one rep at a time. And it says, it's rush hour at Gold's Gym in Venice, California. Athletes and muscle men and actors of all shapes are gathered for their Tuesday lift, curling, benching, posing, flexing, taking refuge from an unusually cold and rainy evening. Over by the weight rack, aspiring actor slash bodybuilder slash real estate player, Joseph Bienna, Joe to his friends, is manhandling a couple of massive dumbbells as the Men's Health video crew jockeys for its best angle. As the camera rolls, Bienna wrestles the weights onto his lap, lies down on an inclined bench, kicks the weights into position, and executes 8 dumbbell presses with expert precision. Go for a stretch at the bottom, he instructs as he pumps the weights up and down. Come all the way up and squeeze. The way he sells it, you'd almost believe that holding a few hundred pounds of steel over your face and then lowering and raising them until the fibers of your pectoral muscles feel like they're going to separate from your sternum is the most fun a guy can have on a drizzly evening in SoCal in late December 2021. He's a natural,
at lifting weights, holding center stage, working an audience. The setting is rich with history. Nicknamed the Mecca of bodybuilding, Gold's is the stomping and lifting and squatting ground for all the sport's greats, made famous in 1977's Pumping Iron, the semi-fictional documentary that set a young muscle man from Thal, Austria, on the course to become the institution known as Arnold Schwarzenegger, the same guy whose massive fading photo hovers on the wall just above our heads, the same guy who also happens to be the father of the man genially banging out dumbbell presses in front of me. If you've heard the name Joseph Biena, you probably know a bit about his history, how his mother, Guatemalan-born Mildred Biena, was the housekeeper for Arnold and his then-wife Maria Shriver when Joseph was born in 1997, how his mother kept the truth of his paternity a secret throughout his childhood, and how in 2011, when the resemblance between father and son became impossible to ignore, it came out publicly that Joseph was the child of one of the most famous and successful men on the planet. Mildred described exactly how her son found out his dad's identity in an interview that year. When Joseph's grandmother sat him down to explain that Arnold Schwarzenegger was his father, he exclaimed, "Cool," and then silence. Biena and his mother declined to elaborate further on their radically transformed lives, leaving the public guessing about how he handled the sudden revelation. Until now. Over the 4 hours we spent talking about those turbulent times and his evolving relationship with his dad, it was clear that the trials of his first 24 years have forged a powerful sense of self. He's proud of his Latino heritage, and he hopes people will see past his childhood and get to know and respect him for his own accomplishments as he crushes his day job selling houses at Aria Properties, a Marina Del Rey real estate office, and establishes himself as an actor. First up is the action pick Lava, in which he has a lead role, and the low-budget sci-fi thriller Encounters is on the way. Hey, you got to start somewhere. Of course, people scoffed at Arnold when he started out, and then he became one of the highest paid actors in Hollywood, living proof that ambition, faith, and unshakable confidence can take you pretty far. For many men, especially guys born in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, Schwarzenegger has always loomed large as an exemplar of what's possible. If you work hard and make good on your talents and steadfastly refuse to take no for an answer, as aspiring as that life has been for many of us, it's also a hell of a legacy to live up to, enough to deflate someone. In this, we're all Biena's brothers. Whatever alchemy of genes, upbringing, and training brought it on, Joseph Biena is wrestling through a condition that everyone from Sophocles to Shakespeare to Freud has told us is unavoidable. It's right there in this scratchy, tingling opening theme song to Pumping Iron. Every man wants to be bigger than dad. But what happens when an oversized picture of your dad towers over you on the wall of your gym? One of hundreds, if not thousands, of gyms in the LA area, and an interesting choice of training and interview venue for a son who says that he doesn't want to live in his father's shadow. Can anyone ever be bigger than his dad? It's been more than 10 years since that day when all hell broke loose in his family, and those years have brought enough perspective that Biena is now willing to open up about it. Those are really big parts of my life that no one really knows, he says. Bakersfield, California, where Biena grew up with his mother and older siblings, is about 100 miles north of L.A., but the suburban desert community, sometimes disparaged as the armpit of California, couldn't be farther from the glitz of Hollywood. It was a humble home, and we didn't have much, Biena says. Still, the early years were happy, learning to cook with his mother, now a culinary school graduate and a chef, speaking Spanish with his siblings. There are four on his mom's side, ranging in age from 32 to 42. Celebrating his Guatemalan heritage through food, culture, and music. That's a huge part of me, he says. My mom's whole side is Guatemalan. We have a lot of Colombian family. Nearly everyone on that side is Latin America. The music of Vicente Fernandez plays loudly at every family gathering, where mom's take on tamales baked in banana leaves instead of corn husks is a favorite. Into this period of relative tranquility, Biena recounts, the media frenzy came. I remember the day very vividly, he says. I was in the eighth grade, fifth or sixth period, and I get called out of class to leave. And my mom's there, and she's like, "We got to go. Everyone's finding out about you and who your father is." News trucks swarmed the house. Photographers hounded the family. I'm 13, he remembers. Your body's transforming, your mind is transforming, and now my life transformed before my eyes. Their home under siege, Mildred and Joe took a road trip, hiding out with relatives in Texas. Through it all, the probing eyes of the press, the ongoing pressure to stay incognito, mother and son stood strong. She was really the only person I had, and I was the only person that she had. No one knew, and everyone wanted the details. We had each other's backs. Vienna declined to share exactly when he first talked to his dad after the revelation, and Schwarzenegger could not be reached for an interview. In his freshman year at Frontier High, Vienna discovered that people looked at him differently. The trust factor became really difficult. He couldn't tell who his friends were. Athletically inclined but chubby, he was cut from the basketball and soccer teams, and he considered giving up on sports. The turning point came when his buddy Cesar tried to badger him into joining the swim team. Vienna balked, worried about how he'd look in a Speedo. But Cesar was relentless, and swimming had one big advantage over the other sports. There was no tryout, he says. Vienna's long arms and powerful upper body engendered a fortuitous pairing of athlete and sport. I was born for the water, he says. Along with trophies, recognition, and a sleek physique came confidence, focus, and a new willingness to engage with fellow students. In his senior year, he was president of Frontier High. That was a real honor, he says, and the first indication that he could thrive on his own and be a leader. Hanging out with Vienna, you notice quickly that his pronouncements practically overflow with positive hyperbole. Guatemalan food isn't just good, it's amazing. He is so fortunate to have had his college experience at Pepperdine University. Latino culture is so proud. He doesn't drink much and he barely curses. At one point, he even apologizes for using the word ass. If it sounds grating, however, it's not. It's endearing. The unabating positivity is just one of many ways in which his bearing and behavior call to mind his father. And for a stranger who's been a Schwarzenegger fan for decades, interacting with Vienna is almost a time-traveling experience. One moment you forget whose son you're talking to. The next, he'll gesture wildly with both arms. I'm obsessed with schnitzel. And you're watching Arnold plug the Terminator on The Tonight Show. Vienna is close with Schwarzenegger. Photos of them socializing or exercising together are frequent media fodder. But he's wary of talking about dad too much. He does tell me, though, that they eventually bonded over fitness. Schwarzenegger gave Vienna the Encyclopedia of Modern Bodybuilding, which he co-authored, to guide his training. Even though I would call him any time, I was too proud, Vienna says. I went straight to the book. I wanted to figure it out myself. Later, he reached out for his tips on building his shoulders, and they started training together around his 18th birthday. Naturally, it involved a trip to Gold's. I was so nervous, he says, but he took it all in. The rituals, the routines, and perhaps most important, the demeanor. I was being observant, trying to see what he was doing and the way he was acting, says Vienna. He learned to grip the bar on bench presses properly, turn his wrist on dumbbell curls, drop deep into the hole on squats. He learned to feel the stretch in his traps, the squeeze in his pecs, the deep burn in his muscles that signals growth. Through it all, he developed an understanding that the gym, loud and rough and tumble though it is, can be a crucible for transformation. When he got serious about lifting in college, he says, I was able to acquire a bodybuilding mentality that I could shape my body however I want. After having success as a swimmer, Vienna found that with similar effort and discipline, he could build up, shred down, or do a combination of both. I made insane progress, he says, of his college years. His current regimen is, to say the least, involved. Lots of sets, plenty of isolation moves, 2 hours, 6 days a week, plus 20 minutes of fasted cardio in the morning. One of the big things I learned from Dad was not to have the 10 rep mentality, he says. It's pushing yourself to the limits and going that extra mile, getting those extra reps and half reps until you're basically dying. To the uninitiated, it sounds miserable, but Vienna lights up as he talks about lifting. Research from the University of Missouri suggests that particular individuals may have an unusually high pleasure response to exercise, and Vienna appears to be one of them. Though he stops short of equating it with sex, as satisfying to me as coming, Arnold once declared of lifting weights, he's rhapsodic nonetheless. Since I started working out seriously in college, he says, it was instant gratification. You might think, given his love of the gym and the genetic gifts lurking in his double helix, that Vienna might feel pressure to jump into physique competitions, but he doesn't. His saner, or maybe we should just say sane, attitude towards fitness ensures that his physique, 6'1" and 190 pounds, while impressive, remains more approachable and athletic than that of most bodybuilders, more a wide receiver than offensive lineman. his Instagram feed at ProJoe2, which has a healthy but hardly A-list 351,000 followers, is more like a primer on living a happy life than an endless homage to big orexia. There are so many other things I care about more than fitness, he says. My lifestyle, my family, my friends, having fun at work. There's a balance. It's not just fitness all the time. It's a blessedly un-Arnoldinian sentiment. With a new slew of actors getting marvelized by the month, muscles are necessary for the types of roles Vienna wants, and he knows that it takes more than that to scale the Hollywood sign. Given the shifting landscape of the entertainment industry, he was initially unsure how to proceed when he started considering acting as a career path. My dad is old school. He doesn't believe in handouts. He believes hard work pays off, and so do I, says Vienna. I love the word honor, and I'm very prideful in the sense that if I use my dad's contacts or ask him for favors, I wonder what honor is that going to bring me. The same impulse drove his decision not to take a last name that might open doors for him in Hollywood. When I go to auditions, they don't know who I am because we don't have the same last name. When he books a gig, he says, I know it's all me. Dad had three words of acting advice. Vienna says, do the reps. The on-the-nose counsel struck Vienna as funny at first. I was like, really? Like in workouts? What are you talking about? With time and experience, however, he discovered the wisdom in Arnold's simple directive. Acting can seem like alchemy, the magical act of becoming. But as with building your body, much of it is a zen-like matter of putting in the hours. You have to get the shit done. If a scene requires 20 pages of dialogue, Vienna says, I say the lines over and over again, with a scene partner, an acting coach, or just by myself, repeating, repeating, repeating until it's muscle memory, to a point where you can wash your clothes, do your dishes, basically do anything and spit the lines out. About as glamorous as lateral raises. But in the gym, repetitive work is the price of success. Another invaluable piece of Arnoldinian guidance that Vienna took to heart, find a mentor. 4 years ago, while still in college, Vienna reached out to Eric Morris, the storied acting coach who had guided Schwarzenegger to a Golden Globe for 1976's Stay Hungry. As his father had a half century before, Vienna hit it off with Morris, and he's worked with him 3 or 4 days a week ever since. When Joseph first came to me, I called him Mr. Smiles a lot, said Morris, sharp and perceptive at 90 years old. That's all he did on stage. Over time, though, he learned that it was okay to express his frustration, his anger, his vulnerability. He became more affectable and expressive. Vienna admits that his early efforts in student films were clunky and self-conscious, but he found his stage legs in class 2 years ago playing Biff, the conflicted son of the title character in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, tearing up the 40s-era dialogue, Pop, I'm a dime a dozen and so are you. He uncovered new depths and feeling and tapped into experiences from his life. The process helped him psychologically too, he says, almost like therapy. That was game-changing for me, he adds, noting that he was able to draw on the same intensity on Lava. Getting that end of my range made me realize I could be a serious working actor, he says. Morris is reluctant to compare elder to younger, but he's enthusiastic about his student's promise. Joseph is on his own journey, with his own specific obstacles. He's beautifully evolving. As he matures and gets more training, he'll take on more complex roles. Asked where he sees himself in 10 years, Vienna doesn't hesitate. I'm an award-winning actor with lots of real estate experience, and I'm on a boat in Miami, sipping a Mai Tai with my buddies, getting ready for the next movie. Okay, he's got big dreams. He's 24, after all. Perhaps the real takeaway is that Vienna is seemingly unafflicted by rage, resentment, or pathological ambition, the kind that sometimes derails the children of the famous. It took a little bit of me to realize that I don't have to do what my dad did, he says. I don't have to get into acting or bodybuilding. I'm very motivated and driven. I'm happy about my relationship with my dad, but I'm more happy that I'm finding joy in what I'm doing and that I'm doing exactly what I've always dreamed about. As he speaks, I think about all the men I know who have terrible relationships with their dads, abusive ones, remote ones, absent ones. And I think about Vienna, together with his dad, cycling around Santa Monica, sharing a beer, working out at Gold's, doing curls on the preacher bench. A lot of guys struggle with trying to make their dad proud or trying to get out of their dad's shadow. But as long as you're doing what you want to do, then it all comes. Of course, maybe those guys don't have such nice dads. If you took a magic eight ball to learn more about Vienna's next chapter, and fitness and real estate and the uncertain carnival ride that is the entertainment industry, you'd get a definitive cannot predict now, but we like his chances. The story appears in the March 2022 issue of Men's Health. All right. Great article by Andrew Heffernan. Great job, Andrew. And a very interesting article about Joseph Bienna. So we wish him the best. He's got a great, great life ahead of him, looks like. So doing it right. All right, guys, one more article for you. I think you're going to enjoy this one. This is the July 10th, 1972 issue of Sports Illustrated. It was the first article about bodybuilding. And the article, of course, is by Charles Gaines. And the pictures in the article were by George Butler. And the title of the article is called Cutting Some Fancy Figures. Outside the auditorium, or pavilion as it's called, it is a gorgeous Sunday afternoon at the Mountain Park Amusement Center in Holyoke, Massachusetts. A roller coaster clatters up and down a wooden trestle. Children fly around in little whirly things that look like boats with wings. There are clam bars, pizza stands, dart throws, cotton candy booths, a commando machine gun stall. The sky is raucous blue, the sun is hot, and a lot of people are laughing. Outside Mountain Park, on all sides, stretches Holyoke suburbia, big homes and fine lawns that make the place feel mischievous and isolated, an island of gaudery in the midst of all that yawning green, especially today. Today in the pavilion, a body contest is going on, a festival of flesh, maybe the gaudiest of all sporting events and strange as a llama race to the average suburban fan. Leon Brown, who works in a laundry in New York, is there posing for the 1972 Mr. East Coast title. Following the din that greeted his high-chested glide on stage, there is a total hush over the 1,200 assembled. He stands in the center of the stage, illuminated by a single spot, alone atop the leopard skin posing dais. He shifts. He fixes his eyes somewhere at the back of the huge auditorium and slides into his first pose to a pandemonium of shrieks and applause. Brown's mouth stays a little ajar. His eyes are flat, concentrating. It looks like somebody might be teaching him canasta. He shows the judges his breathtakingly graceful legs that you could lose a dime in the separations between the almond-shaped muscles of each frontal thigh. The gastrocnemius muscles of the calves bulge like upside-down hearts. Then he pivots on one foot like a dancer, jiggles the muscles tense, and finds a back pose. It's dynamite, trapezius, deltoid, infraspinatus, the glaring latissimus dorsi. All the workhorse muscles of his back gleam like oiled chocolate in delineated, organized mounds above his glare-blue posing trunks. The response from the crowd is mightily near hysterical. Brown holds the pose and holds it. It is one of his best, and as he holds it until the muscles begin to quiver from the strain, then he flows down the line of the pose into a side shot, left wrist clutched by the right hand behind his back. Pectoral muscles of the chest round and dense as a grapefruit on top of a long concave curve of his rib cage. He turns his stiffened, flexed left arm in front of the judges, laying all three heads of his tricep brachii on them. It's too much. The shouts thicken into moans. Oh my God, says a man near the front. Oh my God. Oh my God. Brown has them pinned and he knows it. Watching him finish his routine is akin to watching a hawk plunder a rabbit in an open field. A clean swooping. There's no necessity for fancy moves. Bodybuilding as a competitive sport never has had the national sanction or interest that its participants think it deserves. To most Americans, it just seems so weird. All those huge people who seem to resemble ordinary men all the way a tattoo does a birthmark, posing and flexing up there in those little skimpy trunks. Unflattering myths develop that they are all muscle-bound, coordinatively helpless lumps. Bodybuilders who are good at other sports are really the rule rather than the exception. That they will slide to fat the moment they stop that unnatural exercise, only if they keep on eating as much. And that they are all homosexuals anyway. You try telling them that one. And our collective imagination pictures dark, fleshy exhibitions and seedy Ys and high school gyms full of wine-drunk voyeurs. It isn't really like that, but bodybuilding itself hasn't done much to clarify the image. For years, the sport has been too vexed and mired by internecine skirmishes between its two competition sponsoring organizations, the AAU and the International Federation of Bodybuilders, to worry about many of its larger problems. Ed Jubenville is the promoter and MC of the Mr. East Coast Contest, an IFBB event. He's also held the title of the world's greatest muscle control artist for 25 years. He can make his muscles dance like no other man in the sport. Jubenville has put on 43 contests in Mountain Park. The Mr. East Coast is not one of the most important annual events, not in the same league, say, as the Universe or America or World, but it's always a classy competition, and some big dudes are on hand. Mike Katz, the 1970 IFBB Mr. America, Mr. Northeast, Mr. International, etc., who ranks among the top four or five bodybuilders in the country, world, universe right now, won it 2 years ago. He is a judge this time. Gordon Babb, best back at the Mr. America, is in the audience, and so are Warren Fredericks, often called the human anatomy chart, and 1969 Mr. World Tony Carroll, who is giving out catalogs for his muscle hugger torso shirts. Before anything begins on stage at a body contest, the audience always knows who is there. You spot them as they walk in. Bodybuilders are often individualistic to the point of kinkiness, and they have a way of standing out. As Mike Katz says, they are the only athletes whose sport you can tell just by looking at them. It's not just the size that accounts for this, or even their fabulous proportions. Katz's chest is 58 inches and his waist is 31, a difference of 27 inches as compared to the average of 7 or 8. His biceps is 21 inches around, about the size of a small woman's waist. It has more to do with an odd variety of self-consciousness, a highly developed aesthetic sense of self that comes from having more or less the same relationship to your own body that an artist does to his artwork. A bodybuilder's body is the product of what he does. And when he walks around, he is not just getting from one place to another. He is exhibiting the results of his labor. For Mike Katz to get those mind-boggling pectoral muscles that push his chest out so far he can balance a glass of water on it, he has pumped iron 4 hours a day for 10 years. So generally, he doesn't walk at all. He struts, putting it all out front, chest high, arms bowed slightly away from the body to show the spread of his laterals. It's a wonderful movement. It makes you realize that, as Katz says, most people walk around looking like pieces of junk. The Mountain Park Pavilion is about 150 feet long and shaped like a barn. Beams studded with light bulbs transverse the dome ceiling. The audience sits shoulder to beefy shoulder in rows of connected wooden chairs. They are animated, noisy, and big, these fans, maybe in the same vicarious way that a lot of hockey fans are mean. To the left of the stage is the warm-up room or pit where the builders prepare for competition, anointing their shaved bodies with baby oil to bring out the highlights under the spot, and pumping up, blitzing the muscles with dumbbell and tension exercises that oxygenate and swell them and bring the veins closer to the skin. Veins are very important here. Behind the screen, the 22 builders getting in last-minute pull-ups, tricep presses, flies, and curls mutter and shuffle like cattle in a boxcar. They have been divided into three height classes, those under 5'7", those over 5'9", and those in between. There will be 5 trophies for each class, plus overall awards for best poser, most muscular, and of course, Mr. East Coast. Ed Jubenville announces the shorts. They file on stage from the pit and stand facing the audience, arms bowed, chest out, under the full glare of the house lights. There are 8 of them, ranging in size from Kennedy Gomez, a slender, wistfully smiling boy, to Buddy Landau, who is as heavily muscled as a water buffalo. But even the most untrained eye can pick out the class. It's the 6th man in line, Leon Brown. The others might as well have stayed behind the screen. From their table at the front of the stage, Katz and the other judges gaze up at the shorts. Officially, they are looking for 3 things: general appearance, symmetry, and muscularity. But what they actually appraise is how big the muscles are, how well proportioned and how cleanly each muscle group is defined or cut from the ones around it. Jubenville has the shorts make 4-quarter turns to the right, pausing between each to give the judges a shot of both sides and the back. Then he sends them off and brings them back one at a time for a 2 or 3 minute individual posing routine under the spot. It is in these routines that body contests are won and lost, and where the peculiar essence of the sport best manifests itself. Good posing is partly a technical matter of knowing how to exhibit your strong points and obscure any weak ones. But beyond that, it is an ability like diving or hitting a baseball that depends on the intuitive resources of timing and coordination. If it is done as Leon Brown does it during a couple minutes he occupies the dais with perfect dignity and finish, there is nothing ridiculous or even remotely embarrassed about it. Suddenly, it is no longer a greased, nearly naked man you are watching, but a clean, hard geometry of circles and curves. Even Brown seems detached from what he is. Looking down at his flexed biceps, his face shows no recognition of the flesh. He seems to be looking at just an arrangement of stresses. There is no competition for Brown in the mediums, a fact that disappoints the crowd. They cheer only perfunctorily. But three of the talls are huge, and as soon as the group comes out, the crowd senses that there might be a real contest for Mr. East Coast after all. Bob Klez, Errol Cattaro, and Ray Delaney each sport a lot of bulk. Klez lingers on the dais, taking his time over mostly chest and stomach poses. He is bearded and has tattooed dragons on each calf that wreathe whenever he flexes his legs. Cattaro, who is probably the best back in the contest, keeps it up in front of the judges. His positions are long-lined and dramatic. And whenever he does turn around, he looks as if he's engaged in some kind of fierce prayer. It is Delaney who seems the greatest threat. He is massive. His skin is paler than anyone's, but he has not mixed iodine in his baby oil to darken it. His body looks like a gigantic piece of carved candle wax, and the classic sculptural poses he puts it through are effective. But sometime during his routine, or maybe later, in the pose-off that he has with Klez for the first in their class, it becomes clear that Delaney, even with his beer keg chest and arms that look like they are slugged full of sausage, cannot do it. Nor Klez, nor Cattaro. That all the bulk on the East Coast is not going to do it today against Leon Brown's fearful symmetry. For the 2 or 3 minutes while he was stretching out that back pose and turning that triceps in front of the judges, Brown had managed to do what bodybuilding is all about, to make a form of sport and a form of art merge momentarily in the sheer exhibition of a body trained as far as the muscles will allow, pushed against the natural inertia of tissue into its final form. Before the first trophy is handed out, the crowd is shouting, "Leon, Leon." He swept it. He won Mr. East Coast, his class, most muscular, and best poser. With each new trophy, Leon made a little bow, expressionless still, and threw the ravening crowd a new pose. They did not stop yelling for a long time, those 1,200 big people, and the carnival atmosphere that body contests always create took a long time to blow off. A number of people even stayed in their chairs to wait for Brown, Klez, Delaney, and the others to leave after they had showered. Eyes moving from left to right, they watched each of them strut out into the park in that odd, high-chested way. A lot of mouths were pursed, and it was easy to believe that some of those people might be wondering about the same urge that Carl Shapiro muses on in The Leg. The body, what is it, Father, but a sign? To love the force that grows us, to give back. What in thy palm is senselessness and mud? The end. All right. Great classic article by Charles Gaines in the issue of Sports Illustrated from July 1972. And it's fitting that it also featured Leon Brown in that article. Rest in peace, Leon, who also passed away last year, I believe in the fall of 2021. This was 50 years ago when he lit up the stage at the Mr. East Coast contest in Holyoke, Massachusetts. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed the show. I did. It was great interviewing Charles Gaines. We'll be back next week with another interview on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Until then, have a great weekend. Take care of yourself. And we'll see you next week. Take care.